to implement the U.S. Mitchell Plan to reduce the level of violence by the obvious means, namely introducing international monitors. That's a good way to lower the level of violence. Worked elsewhere, could work there. The U.S. vetoed the resolution. It then immediately went to the General Assembly, where the U.S. voted against it, along with Israel. And usually the U.S. and Israel vote alone against such resolutions, or in fact most resolutions. But in this case, the U.S. did pick up another couple of countries, a few Pacific islands, so it wasn't alone in enhancing terror. I had some allies. When the U.S. votes against something, it's not only vetoed, but vetoed from the public record. So there's virtually no mention of this in the press, and it'll disappear from history. This was an important period because it was right in the middle of a 21-day period of what is called quiet in the Israel-Palestine conflict, which means only Palestinians were killed. About 20 Palestinians were killed, about half of them children, but there was no very little other violence, so it was a period of quiet, and that's when the U.S. intervened to enhance terror in this fashion. Very efficient way to do it. It wasn't the only example. 10 days earlier, on December 5th, there was an important meeting in Switzerland, which was also vetoed from history. You can search and you won't find any discussion of it, very little discussion. This was a meeting of the high contracting parties of the Geneva Convention. The Geneva Conventions were established right after the Second World War to formally criminalize the crimes of the Nazis. That was their purpose. The Fourth Geneva Convention dealt with occupied territories. This was a meeting of, there are what are called high contracting parties, that is parties which, of course, the United States is one, which are bound by solemn treaty to act to enforce the conventions in any circumstances. The meeting was in Switzerland because Switzerland is the country that's the repository for dealing with this. Every country in the world, with the exception of Israel, literally holds that the Geneva Conventions apply to the occupied territories. Furthermore, it is international law. It's been reiterated at the Security Council without a negative vote. So, for example, in October 2001, the Security Council voted without a veto, without a negative vote, that the Geneva Conventions do apply to the occupied territories. The vote was 14-0, but with one abstention. The United States abstains on those votes. It does not want to come out openly opposing the conventions that were instituted to criminalize the crimes of the Nazis, so it therefore abstains, which kills them. Keeps them out of the press and the historical record, and of course makes them inapplicable. That same thing happened on December 5th of last year. The United States boycotted the meeting, so it's finished. Didn't matter that every participant voted for a strong resolution holding that the Geneva Conventions apply to the occupied territories, which entails that virtually everything the United States is doing there, meaning Israel's doing with U.S. arms, weapons, economic aid, diplomatic support, that's all illegal. Illegal means technically what's called a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, which is a war crime by any standard. But it doesn't matter. The U.S. boycotted it, so therefore it's out of the discussion. And the possibility of reducing the level of violence by the means supported by the entire world in this case, U.S. accepted, are out of the discussion. That's not the only case. This includes all the settlements, you know, that the U.S. pays for, our tax dollars pay for them, that the U.S. protects with military aid, diplomatic support, and so on. It's all gone. If you read this morning's papers, you see that very happy that the Israeli Prime Minister made what's called a concession. Namely, he's allowing Yasser Arafat to leave his little prison, the room to which he's been confined for the last couple of months, Just in order to make sure everybody understands what this is, yesterday, what's called Israel. When you hear about Israeli helicopters attacking something, that means U.S. helicopters, right? Israel doesn't produce helicopters or F-16s. So when you read Israeli helicopters attacked something with missiles, that means U.S. helicopters provided to Israel for that purpose, with the certain knowledge that that's what they're going to be used for. In this case, a couple days ago, they wiped out the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority had been constructing in Gaza for potential state headquarters. There's no significance to this other than humiliation, which is the core principle for dealing with the lower breeds. Every Westerner understands this. You've got to humiliate them, not just kill them, but humiliate them. It's very important. But now Israel, meaning the United States, made a concession. It's allowing Arafat to get out of his prison, to which he's been confined. The reason for letting him out is allegedly that they arrested some people who Israel wants him to arrest for killing an Israeli minister, Minister Zaevi, tourist minister. That's considered a crime. Of course, it is a crime. And the crime is not absolved by the fact that it was retaliation for an earlier crime, a couple of weeks earlier, namely the murder of Abu Ali Mustafa, who's the first political leader, pure, straight political leader, to have been purposely assassinated in this conflict. He was assassinated by what's called an Israeli helicopter, meaning a U.S. helicopter, and introduced political, straight political assassination for the first time. Zaevi was a retaliation. But the Abu Ali Mustafa assassination isn't a crime. In fact, you might explore to see how that's been covered here. It's not a crime, and nobody is confined to his room in order because he didn't arrest the people responsible for that crime, which obviously wouldn't make any sense anyway, because everyone knows who's responsible. They're sitting in the White House and in the government offices in Tel Aviv, so you don't have to confine them in any rooms. You know exactly who they are. It's not a question. You don't have to search for them. But it doesn't count on the same principles that I've been mentioning. Who sent the helicopters? Well, for that we can primarily credit Bill Clinton, although Bush has been continuing too. Just to remind you, the current conflict, the Al-Aqsa Intifada, actually began on September 29th of the year 2000. I'm virtually quoting the U.S. Mitchell report at this point, when the Israeli government, the day after Sharon had entered the Al-Aqsa compound, the mosque, with a big entourage of military as a pure provocation and no other purpose. The day after that, Prime Minister Barak surrounded it with about 1,000 soldiers, and when people came out of the mosque and some kids started throwing stones, they shot at them before it was over. Half a dozen people were killed, and that took off from there. On the first day, October 1st, September 30th, October 1st, October 2nd, Israel began using U.S. helicopters to attack civilian targets, apartment complexes, others, killing a couple dozen people. On October 3rd, Clinton made the biggest deal in a decade to send Israel new helicopters, biggest deal in a decade, including spare parts for Apache attack helicopters that had been sent a couple of weeks earlier. Well, that's a terrific way of enhancing terror. There was no Palestinian fire at that time. You know, it was just stone throwing. But as soon as our client state, offshore military base, starts using our attack helicopters to murder civilians, the way to enhance terror is obviously to send them more. Well, that's the government. The press can also cooperate in enhancing terror, namely by not reporting it. And they didn't. So if you check, you discover that although this is perfectly public knowledge, like you read in the Israeli press or the military journals and so on, the press refused to report it. Notice I'm not saying failed to report it, but rather refused, because it was specifically brought to the attention of editors of leading journals, and they essentially said this is not the right story. So to this day, it hasn't been reported except, you know, in the dissident press. Bush continued when he came into office, and so you have Israeli what are called Israeli helicopters, meaning our helicopters, carrying out assassinations and other atrocities. How many have there been? Well, according to the Israeli press, they say 48 people have been assassinated, liquidated, they say, without a trial, and another 26 happened to be killed who were at the site of the liquidations. The Palestinian Human Rights Group gives the figure of 66, but let's keep to the Israeli figures. So 48 killed and 26 others just happened to be around. There were more yesterday, incidentally, so it goes on. And the reporter, Gidon Levy in Haaretz, gives a lot of shocking examples. But it's not, and he also points out, the occasion for his article is that there was a protest to the High Court, an appeal to the High Court, like the Supreme Court, to rule against targeted assassination, a lot of them with helicopters. And the court denied the request, saying that it saw no reason to put an end to these assassinations. So there's no, as Levy points out, there's no way to appeal to anyone in Israel. All they can do is appeal to an international tribunal, since the Israeli government, meaning the U.S. government, because remember, they can act up to the point where the U.S. authorizes it, not an inch beyond. So these will go on. What about diplomacy? Well, there is some talk about diplomacy. Right now, there's a lot of talk about a Saudi Arabian plan. There's been a lot of reporting about this. Some of the reporting, including the Globe, did point out, and they're right to do so, that this is sort of similar to a plan that Saudi Arabia put forth in 1981, the Fahd plan, in fact, virtually identical to it. But that plan, according to the reports, was killed by the Arab states who didn't want to make peace with Israel. Well, that's not quite exact, so I'll just quote from the second book that Southend was nice enough to publish for me, Fateful Triangle. This is 1983, right after the first plan came along. Here's what actually happened. Try to search for it in the press. Shimon Peres, the leading dove, said that the Saudi Arabian plan threatened Israel's very existence. The Labor Party's official newspaper said that the Israeli government, in reaction to the Saudi peace plan, had sent military aircrafts over Saudi Arabia, effectively warning the United States that if the United States showed any interest in this plan, they'd blow up the oil fields. So it's a threat to the United States with U.S. Phantom jets, incidentally. That's not an unusual conjuncture that's been going on for a while. They didn't have to worry about it because the U.S. wasn't going to allow the plan anyway, but they were worried. The Labor Party Journal described this reaction, Israeli reaction, as so irrational as to cause foreign intelligence services to get out of their files their plans about Israeli bombing of the Saudi oil fields. Amos Elon, very distinguished correspondent, described it as shocking, the Israeli reaction as shocking, frightening, if not downright despair-producing. And similar comments go over to the center-right. Yoel Marcus condemned what he called the frightened, almost hysterical response to the Saudi plan. He said it's a grave mistake. Israel's president, Chaim Herzog, Labor dove, he wrote about it. He said the real author of the Saudi plan is the PLO. And he added that he said that the plan that the PLO, the Saudi PLO plan, was even more extreme than a Security Council resolution of January 1976, which he says was prepared by the PLO. He was at that time Israel's UN ambassador. The plan, and there was such a proposal at the Security Council, it was proposed by the Arab confrontation states, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. It was, in fact, backed by the entire world, by the Russians, Europe, Latin America, all the Arab states, everyone. It was vetoed by the United States, which, as usual, means vetoed from history. So that's not, none of this is discussed. What did the plan call for? Well, it called for the full implementation of official U.S. policy, that is UN 242, which calls for recognized borders and the right of every state to live in peace and security and so on, but with a Palestinian state in the occupied territories. There were then subsequent plans from Saudi Arabia and other Arab states, Europe and others, all blocked by the United States, up to the 1981 plan, which caused such hysteria. Actually, Herzog's comments were not correct. The Saudi Arabian plan was not any different from the January 76 plan, and his claim that both of them were prepared by the PLO is almost certainly false, but it is a reflection of the hysteria among Israeli doves over the threat that there might be a peace proposal that maybe the U.S. would take seriously, although there was very little chance of that because the U.S. was strongly opposed to a peaceful diplomatic settlement and has in fact succeeded in blocking any such settlement for the past 25 years, which again would be headlines if there was any interest in anything but enhancing terror. Well, what was in fact the U.S. reaction? Actually, we don't really know that in detail because nothing's ever reported. Since the U.S. is blocking peace and enhancing violence, it just can't be reported. And this continues up to the very present. When the first Saudi plan was proposed, the Fahd plan, in August 1981, that was right at the time when Israel, with U.S. backing, Israel was beginning to plan the invasion of Lebanon, which took place the following summer. The purpose of the invasion of Lebanon, and the reason for the invasion of Lebanon, it was perfectly open in Israel, was to try to prevent the PLO from continuing its extremely annoying policies of trying to move towards a diplomatic settlement, which Israel doesn't really mind terror much, but they do mind negotiations and diplomacy, because that might mean you have to relinquish the occupied territories. Terror you can kind of deal with. So the idea was to try to prevent the PLO from pursuing these efforts by just driving them out of Lebanon. That was the goal. Finally, I have to give credit where it's due, it finally reached the American press after 20 years of perfectly clear information. I mean, if you take a look at the Fateful Triangle, a lot of quotes from the Israeli top Israeli officials and Israeli press and many more in the following years. But it did reach the New York Times on January 24th of this year. The James Bennett has an article in which he points out accurately that the Israeli government's goal in invading Lebanon and incidentally killing about 20,000 people, the goal was to install a friendly regime and destroy Mr. Arafat's Palestine Liberation Organization. That, the theory went, would help persuade Palestinians to accept Israeli rule in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. That's accurate. And it's nice that after 20 years, it finally made it to a kind of a, you know, line inside a story which nobody will notice. But at least it's there. So now we can quote the New York Times. We don't have to quote massive documentation from the Israeli press and the and journals and the dissident press here. All of that's, notice that that's a textbook illustration of international terrorism, right? It's the use of force to try to attain political goals by intimidation and fear. Actually, it goes way beyond international terrorism. It's a war crime for which you have Nuremberg trials, but it's at least international terrorism. In fact, a major case of it. Backing by the United States all the way right to the present. Well, that's just a sample of what ought to appear in the press if we want to understand what's going on there, small sample. And unless we're willing to face realities like that, there's no point even pretending to be talking about what's happening. Well, that's one aspect of West Asia. What about, I'll end with the next one, what about the axis of evil, the next phase in the war of terror? First question is why George Bush's speechwriters decided to pick that phrase, axis of evil. I presume the reason for using the word evil is because it plays to the domestic audience. At least you can reduce them to the level of children reading fairy tales. So if you can sort of frighten people enough so they kind of huddle under the shadow of the heroic leader, maybe you can get them to think that the hero, semi-divine hero, is protecting them from evil, you know, like you remember when you were a kid, or ancient epics, although they at least have the literary quality. It's different from the plagiarism. And it's very important to do that. because you have to somehow prevent people from watching the attack against them, which is very serious. It's serious on just straight economic grounds, but even more serious if you think of the other plans, like the militarization plans or the plans to destroy the environment, all of which may really literally bring the species to an end. But you certainly don't want people to pay attention to that or the tax cuts for the rich or, you know, the other efforts to silence domestic independence. None of this is proper to look at. And the best way to keep people from looking at it is to have them huddling in terror. So there's big evil out there. What about the axis? I suppose the people who wrote the words know, even if Bush doesn't know what the word axis refers to. There was an axis, but it surely doesn't apply to Iran and Iraq and North Korea. I mean, Iran and Iraq have been at war for 20 years, and North Korea's got nothing to do with it. So whatever it is, it's not an axis. But again, that has the kind of right flavor. It suggests the Nazis and, you know, German troops marching all over the world and so on. Of the whole axis of evil, there's one component of it which may actually be implemented, namely an attack on Iraq. And there are reasons for that. We know for certain that the reasons have nothing to do with Saddam Hussein's crimes. The reason we know that is that during the period of his worst crimes, by far, the U.S. and Britain were supporting him and continued to support him right through the atrocities and afterwards for several years because they didn't care. That included his development of weapons of mass destruction with the assistance of U.S. and British aid, dual technology assistance, which could be applied to weapons of mass destruction, as they knew. And back at that time, in the late 80s, he really was a threat, much more so than now. You know, now Iraq's very much weakened, but then it was a real threat. So we know for certain that can't be the reason. I mean, you'll hear over and over again, as you've been hearing for a long time, that we can't let this guy survive because ultimate criminal, you know, did all these terrible things, gassed his own people, etc., all of which is true, just missing three little words, namely, with our support. You know, which continued. So whatever the reasons may be, it's not those reasons that we can be confident about. What are the reasons? Well, it's not very hard to figure out. Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia. You'd be quite confident that one way or another, the U.S. is going to act to regain control over those oil reserves and their distribution and sale, and to deny them to adversaries. At the moment, France and Russia have a kind of like a privileged access to them, along with Dick Cheney and his company, incidentally. But the U.S. doesn't have privileged access to them and control over them. So something will be done to rectify that. And it's possible that they think that, you know, this is an opportunity to somehow achieve this. Just this morning, the Globe reports, probably correctly, a split between CIA and State Department on one hand and the Pentagon on the other as to who to use to try to restore the system of U.S. control. The CIA and the State Department are dealing with Iraqi generals, who in fact include the ones responsible for the Halabja chemical warfare and other atrocities. But that's okay, because remember, it really wasn't the atrocities or the development of weapons of mass destruction that was a problem. It was disobedience. It's a real problem. Well, that brings us up to the present. Obviously, a lot more to say, but it illustrates very well the kind of contribution that institutions like South End and others like it, many have spawned from it, in fact, can make. They offer ways in which the public can discover what's going on in the world, that includes domestically and internationally, even if it violates the principles, the principle that you only pretend to be upset about other people's crimes, you obscure your own, you eliminate from history anything that doesn't fit nicely. And these are really important things for people to understand, not just intellectually, even if they're just interested in simple things like survival, because at this point that's really threatened.
That was Noam Chomsky on censorship, free speech, and the media. This classic from the AR archives was recorded in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 2002 on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of South End Press. South End stopped publishing a few years ago, but many of its titles have been reissued by Haymarket Books. Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist, is America's leading dissident intellectual. He's the author of scores of books, including two I did with him, Notes on Resistance and Chronicles of Dissent. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. Since its inception, we've made a special effort to record and archive Professor Chomsky's work. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Noam Chomsky on Censorship, Free Speech, and the Media, and for his books, Notes on Resistance and Chronicles of Dissent, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go to our website, alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free copy of printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Martin Folker. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.